All right, welcome back. You're listening to First Coast Connect. I'm Al Ledson, and today is Friday, so that means we got a lot of goodness for you in the media roundtable. Some of the items on the menu: Governor DeSantis appears in Jacksonville to denounce COVID restrictions, Jacoby Pittman's recent public statements, and the controversy that ensued. The city council decides to vote on Randy DeFore's appointment, and a victory for voting rights advocates. Then later, how one organization is prioritizing mental health of new mothers, and that's the full show, so let's get into it today. Right now, sitting around the table with me, I'm in the big chair, but I feel like everybody's kind of in a big chair. I don't know. What does that mean about the big chair, ladies and gentlemen? I don't know. It's
the biggest of chairs.
Okay, maybe I'll have to say that. With me is my friend, my buddy, regular contributor and CEO of Aethon Whitner Group, Charles Griggs. How you doing, man?
Good morning, Al.
And my coworker, Kazmira Harrison of Jacksonville Today. How are you, Kazmira?
Doing okay.
This is the first time you've been on with me. Were you ever on before?
Once.
Well, that doesn't count because it wasn't.
Oh, okay.
This is the one that counts. Then we've got Ben Becker, investigative reporter for Action News. How you doing, sir?
Good morning, Al.
And of course, I cannot forget Mr. David Bauerlein of the Times Union. How you doing, sir?
Very good, Al. Good morning, everybody.
Okay, so listen, you can join us from home on radio, or you can watch video streaming right now on Facebook and the WJCT YouTube page. You can call us at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC On Air, email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or message us on the First Coast Connect Facebook page. Also, make sure you check out our new Instagram page that's at FCC On Air. I don't really do social media all that much, so if you want to get a look at how it works, you got to go to that page. All right, so let's begin with our top story. Yesterday, Governor Ron DeSantis held a press conference at an Irish pub in Jacksonville with Florida Surgeon General Joseph, Joseph Lapato. DeSantis reaffirmed his commitment to keeping COVID-19 restrictions out of the state, such as mask mandates and vaccination requirements. Ben, why this press conference now?
Well, because one thing, COVID has been resurfacing quite a bit. But what I find interesting is the governor is coming out so hard against lockdowns when he himself instituted lockdowns back in April of 2020. So I find it interesting that he's taking such a hard stance now. It's as if what happened before has never existed before. So maybe he believes we all have short-term memory loss. But the fact of the matter is he was a big proponent, at least for a while, of locking down the state of Florida to the point where people would leave Florida to go to Georgia if they wanted to get things done. Whether you wanted a haircut or get your nails done, you left Florida because DeSantis locked down the state. So I find it fascinating the stance that he's taken right now.
David, has anybody talked about locking down again? I guess for me, my issue here is that, like, I hadn't heard any talk from any health officials that we were moving back into a lockdown and mask mandates and all of that stuff.
No, certainly not in Florida. I think there are some states and cities elsewhere that have taken a look at reimposing some of that and sending out, urgent warnings to people to take precautions. But certainly in Florida, that has not happened. And, to Ben's point, there is more of these COVID cases going around. COVID did not eliminate itself. It's still going to be part of our health system for many years. But the good news is these cases are not as life-threatening as the earlier strains. So it's happening. It's still going to happen. We're going to have seasonal shifts just like the flu. But there's been no widespread, certainly on a national level, there hasn't. But I think President Biden has taken to wearing a mask again when he is in some situations. The First Lady, I think, came down with COVID. She was here in Florida recently. So it's going around. There's no doubt about that. And it's part of our life for many years to come.
Yeah, the only issues that we've been having here are around encouragement or enforcement of any type. We haven't had any enforcement inquiries. It has been to remind people that COVID is still here and they should get vaccinated or get a booster shot, and also to take precautions because the numbers are on the rise. But what no one has been talking about lockdowns. That is just you know, fodder for bringing out political talking points. I think people understand that between Fauci and woke, that's what the governor seems to be resting on as he continues to campaign for president.
Yeah, it seems like this is, forgive the pun, I've been working with all these people who love puns every day, but it seems like he's trying to use this as a shot in the arm to his campaign.
Ba-dum-bum.
Thank you, sir. Also, at that press conference, he got a question that he did not like. We're going to play some audio from that.
No. There is the truth. There is something about the truth. It's not everyone doesn't have their own truth. No. You don't get to come here and blame me for some madman. That is not appropriate, and I'm not going to accept it.
So he was responding to someone asking him a question about whether he felt responsibility for the shooting that happened here in Jacksonville. And he clearly, as you heard, disagreed vehemently.
Yeah, he's never really come out and say that that the shooter killed black people.
Yeah, he's never said anything that it's about race at all.
Right. And I think that the problem has been, and the gentleman, Mr. Robinson, was asking his questions or even putting his statement out, you know, in a way that he was trying to make a point. And, you know, the governor was the one who ratcheted the conversation up. But it is clear that people in the black community feel like his rhetoric contributed to the attitude and provided space for this type of horrific terrorist, you know, domestic terrorist tragedy to occur. People believe that. And, you know, whether, you know, if you can debate the fact whether he has blood on his hands, but it is clear to many people in the black community that his policies and rhetoric about his policies and his priorities have not been something that have been friendly to the African-American community, and probably perhaps led to someone believing they had a safe space in order to commit this type of tragedy.
Yeah, when you bring that up, what I also think about is that earlier in the press conference, it was primarily concentrated on COVID-19 and bringing the restrictions back. And I think about that COVID-19 disproportionately affected the African-American community. But the Florida Surgeon General has really made light of COVID-19, so much so that the CDC sent a letter to him in March stating that Florida Surgeon General, his claims about COVID-19 were harmful to the public. Any thoughts about that?
Well, certainly doesn't seem to jibe well if you have the CDC and the Surgeon General of a particular state aren't on the same page. So you have to say, okay, well, who's right and who's wrong in this scenario? And I think there's certainly a body of work that shows that the Florida Surgeon General could possibly be in the wrong here. And of course, there's the ones who feel otherwise. But as for the confrontation that we saw yesterday, I'm not surprised because first and foremost, you know, the idea with DeSantis is, you know, he has taken more confrontational tone often. And if you're a supporter of DeSantis, you want to see that. You want to see him go after people. And if you're on the other side of the fence and you don't like DeSantis, well, then it doesn't make a difference to you anyway. So I don't think that swayed anybody, but it is interesting that, you know, he does lean into this confrontational style,
right,
whether it is COVID, whether it is the mass shooting or anything else that's going to come up. The one part where he doesn't become confrontational, which is interesting, is when he goes up against former President Donald Trump. There he seems to kind of lean back, not lean in. And I'm curious if we're ever going to see a situation where he actually goes after the former president in some way, shape, or form, but that'll be something down the line.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think that like at some point he's going to have to, right?
You would think he's going to have to go on the attack at some point because the president goes after him, but DeSantis doesn't seem to want to engage him, which if I'm DeSantis, that would lean into what I like to do. I want to be able to throw punches with him, but as we've seen with the president or the former president, he's good at being able to work off of people. And you know, certainly when you get a nickname from him, you know that at least you're in his sights.
Yeah.
I think Ben is spot on with that. And really, the interesting thing is that press conference was an attack not only on the Biden administration, but the Trump administration and the criticism of COVID policies of the past two administrations. And yet, what your big takeaway from the news conference is, really, he got riled up about the question about the Dollar General shootings and the implication that he had some responsibility in that. And that just shows, I mean, here you have a news conference that's going to really criticize President Trump's handling of the COVID, and yet that really doesn't come across in terms of it's just sort of coded or, below the radar almost. You got to put the pieces together. It's not a direct attack where he calls out Trump by name. So, but in the case of this question, there's really, when you heard the video, audio tape, there's a lot of anger in his voice.
And not to go off point, but he doesn't even go after Trump on the indictments. You know, he often still sides with the idea that Trump is being singled out, when there's a real great opportunity for him to go after Trump to say, hey, you know, you're crooked or whatever you want to use, because you have multiple indictments. But again, maybe down the line, he'll go after that.
Isn't it a natural reaction for the governor or anyone to be associated with, you know, finding blame for something or for a tragedy such as this, to lash out?
I think that I think it's normal for I don't know how to couch this, but normal for a civilian. I think that, like, you know, but when the public eye is on you, and I think that the thing that we have heard from a lot of political pundits is that like on a national level, DeSantis doesn't seem to be polished enough to work to be the president of the United States. That being said, we also had Donald Trump, who is totally an outlier from everything that we think of as presidential, at least what we used to think of as presidential. Like, that mold has been broken by Donald Trump. I wanted to pick up a line that Ben laid out, though. I think what the issue is ultimately, like, there's a lot of ammunition to take on Donald Trump, but the issue is the base. Donald Trump seems to do no wrong with his base, and DeSantis is angling to get that base. So if he's angling to get that base and you've got this guy leading it right now, I think it's better for DeSantis and all the Republican candidates to kind of walk very softly and hope that, like, that candidate, Donald Trump, ends up taking himself out of commission, and then they can move in and be crowned as the heir apparent.
That seems to be the plan.
Yeah, I think he's definitely trying to present himself as a Donald Trump light, trying to carve out political safe space until such time that that Trump is either disqualified because of legal reasons or is eliminated by people other than his base, other political operatives. But the challenge with that is that, you know, no one really knows who you are. You know,
right.
You haven't really carved out a personality for your campaign. You're just kind of blah. Right, you haven't really stood on anything except cultural issues, and that's not going to get it. I think that in the end, what we're probably going to see is some real policy differences emerge, like what we see on abortion rights. That is a dividing factor in the Republican Party right now. You know, because many people believe that they've gone too far, since Roe Wade was sort of overturned. They feel like that they've gone too far, and now they've put themselves in a predicament where the majority of the country, doesn't like the fact that they've gone this far with this issue. So they're going to have to at some point, stand on some policy issues, and people will, have to make decisions there.
You can join the conversation at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC on air. First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. And you can find us on Facebook and YouTube and Instagram. You know the handles. So shifting to local politics, City Council member Jacoby Pittman is making headlines for her recent appearances in the aftermath of the Jacksonville mass shooting, first at a prayer vigil and again at a community event hosted by city leaders. Her actions have inspired a wave of backlash from the community. And I believe I read somewhere, I can't remember the activists or who it was, but they were saying that they were going to start the movement to recall Councilmember Pittman. Any thoughts?
Well, I don't think those recall elections seldom actually happen, but it does show some real dissatisfaction with her that is even being talked about. And, you know, the whole thing with the Councilwoman Pittman at that prayer vigil when the governor showed up is she could have said, you know, I don't agree with the governor on a lot of his policies. I know you don't, but he's here. Let's let him talk. Let's hear him out. Instead, she basically said, you know, he's bringing us gifts. I don't want to turn away something bringing us gifts. It felt really transactional, kind of like, well, he's bringing some money, so let's let him speak. And it really rung hollow, I think, to people who are dealing with this, the human tragedy of what had happened. And then later she kind of backtracked a lot, or not really backtracked, but said, you know, she disagreed with a lot of the governor's policies. And it wasn't even her idea to invite him, even though she was the organizer of this prayer vigil. So it has hurt her politically. But I'm really skeptical about these recall election petitions. It's very hard to recall somebody in Jacksonville.
Yes, yeah, a high bar to have someone recalled. But David and Ben have been around here long enough to remember 2012 when then Mayor Alvin Brown did not show up to then President Barack Obama's campaign event. And many people believe that that was the biggest political blunder a black politician ever made in this community. Only to be outdone by this one, right? This is an emotional moment for the community who was grieving, had an opportunity to sort of stare down, you know, one of the factors they believe that caused this tragedy, and it was sort of taken away from them. And while people may understand, they're not going to forget. And while they may not be able to recall Councilman Pittman, she's going to have to work hard in order to regain the trust of the community around this issue.
And we're going to go to the phones. We've got Stanley in downtown. Stanley, how are you this morning?
Good morning to everybody. My main concern is, a community, the difference between a good community and a great community is leadership. And I've been in Jacksonville all my life, during this 70 years, what I'm saying. That's funny. But the point is, we've been doing the same thing over and over again, and nothing has changed. Could I get y'all comment on that?
Stanley, thank you so much for calling in. So Stanley's point would be that, like, nothing changes in this city. I don't agree with that. I think that there's been a lot of change in this city, and I think when you look at history, you see that, like, we tend to move in these ways that are reminiscent. Like, we repeat it a lot, but every time you may go through something that feels like it's a repeat, you get a little bit of progress forward, and then you step back, and you get a little bit of progress forward, and then you step back. And I think that, like, you know, I've been in Jacksonville for 40 some odd years, and I think that that's what I see, is that, like, we move two steps forward, maybe we move a step back. We move two steps forward, and we're back. And everybody's quiet.
No. I was going to say that the challenge is when situations like this, and having discussions with people in the community who've come to me and asked, you know, what do we do now? You know, this has really been described as Jacksonville's George Floyd moment, right? Where this is sort of a wake-up call to what's really been going on, and people get to identify endemic situations and systemic situations from, you know, that have permeated throughout this community. And many people point back to consolidation. We've never really remedied or dealt with the issues around consolidation. And then you elevate that to a state level where you have policies coming down from, you know, from the legislature and the governor's office that impede progress in the black community or impede understanding of cultural values. It's mind-boggling, and it's threatening at the same time. So when someone like Stanley points out leadership, I think what he's probably saying is significant leadership that ushers in real change, right? Something we can see, something we can touch and feel, where we see real progress. Newtown and Grand Park, nothing's really changed in that area in the last 30 years. If anything, it's gotten worse.
I agree with you. I would just say that, like, the point that you made about consolidation, you know, consolidation was created to keep black people out of power in Jacksonville. And I would say, and it has been effective in so many ways, but also, you know, you brought up Alvin Brown. We had a black mayor. We currently have African-American people that are moving forward. So it, I agree with you that not enough progress has happened, but like the intended goal of consolidation, it slowed things. It slowed progress down significantly, but we've made some cracks and we're moving forward, I would say.
Yeah, I would say that as well. But if you look around in other parts of the community, you see these communities growing. Mandarin
agreed,
and so
agreed,
far,
agreed.
You know, San Marco and so forth. You see these communities growing, and then you look in Northwest Jacksonville, Newtown, Grant Park, you know, Durkeyville in some cases, you see the communities either stagnant or going backwards. And that is directly pointed. You can point directly to leadership and then Stanley's point.
Yep.
But it's also, it's not really the immediate leadership. It is all of the leadership. And people have to make it a priority and not be looking at these, you know, sort of fake, faux pas cultural issues that have no impact on real policy that changes communities.
And I'll talk to consolidation. A former member of city council once told me when we had the 50th anniversary of consolidation, I asked, well, what about the broken promises of consolidation? And they said, oh, they're not broken promises. They just haven't been fulfilled yet. I'm like, it's been 50 years.
Right.
What are you talking about? Right. And then to David's point, you know, he's talking about how Jacoby Pittman's situation and how it felt transactional. Well, that is Jacksonville politics. It is transactional. And we see it all the time. I mean, we're seeing it currently with a lot of the issues with Randy DeFore, which we'll get into later in the show here. But you have a lot of, you know, Democrats who will go over to the Republican side, or Republicans, well, maybe go over to the Democrat side, all depending on individual situations. So, yes, things are very transactional here, and it reared its ugly head in this mass shooting situation, and it didn't go over well.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, all politics, you know, is transactional, and definitely, like, you know, when you look at Jacksonville politics, you can see it. But I think, you know, what landed really hard is the fact that it feels like Jacoby Pittman is working from a playbook for black politicians that worked, you know, in the 90s, in the 2000s or whatever. And we have moved in a place where the populace, where black folks, frankly, are just tired of hearing that type of rhetoric from their leaders. And they want to see, like, to Charles' point, that you see these parts of town that just stagnate because of leadership. They want to see that leadership take hold of it and move forward.
And I should point out the transaction here is the $1 million check that the governor came for EWU. That's part of the transactional politics that we're talking about. That is, you know, at the crux of the matter. And, you know, one person who's spoken out about this, of course, is Representative Angie Nixon, who's, you know, been to that voice of saying, look, we do have to move beyond these type of, to your point, Alec, the older school way of doing things, whether it's the 90s or whatever, and look beyond that. Now, you can't put a dollar amount on what happened in Newtown, but certainly it would appear Jacoby Pittman did, and that's problematic for a lot of people.
Yeah, I don't think that the leadership in the black community, Jacoby Pittman included, are going to let the governor off the hook for this. Mm-hmm. This is going to warrant long-term conversations. You know, Angie Nixon, Representative Angie Nixon, and Senator Tracy Davis are at the forefront of this, and of course, Councilman Pittman and others. But I think it's clear that what the black community wants is empathy and real solutions related to the issues that are going on in the community.
We've got a comment from Ed on Facebook. He said, when an elected government official doesn't make an appearance at a place of a tragedy, they get attacked. And if they don't show up, they also get attacked, regardless of whether it's someone like DeSantis or Biden. If DeSantis didn't show up, what would the pundits be saying?
Well, I think that I'm going to disagree with that. I mean, he's more than welcome to show up, and he's more than welcome to say something. But in that space and in that time, you have to be able to feel the emotions and read the room and feel the emotions of what's just happened. And I would say that if you're a politician or individual, just a regular person, if you didn't look in the mirror that night and wonder to yourself, you know, did anything I did have anything to do with this? Could it have possibly? Then you're not a man. You know, you have to put some humanistic tendencies on this. And I think that's what's missing from the leadership of the state. we haven't really heard from elected officials from the other side. It's just been kind of silent on this issue. But they'll talk about these other things like, you know, banning books and you know, banning AP African-American history and other, these other cultural issues that really don't matter in the grand scheme of things to them.
And the, and the words that were out there were thoughts and prayers.
Right.
Well, let's see what happens. I mean, you have a Mayor Donna Deegan who has said that she wants to bring more investment into older neighborhoods that were left behind by the promises or broken promises of consolidation. Jacoby Pittman is saying that she is going to put together a package and bring it to city council of investment in those neighborhoods. And I know there's, you know, this is seems like it's there's rhetoric and there's results. And let's see what the results are
I think, moves forward on this.
And so I think that's important to watch as well. I mean, so, you know, there's what I'm saying is Jacoby Pittman had 2 minutes of I don't want to defend her too much because it was a bad response in that situation. But if you want to judge her on 2 minutes, let's wait and see what she does in terms of bringing investments, proposals to correct some of the solutions that that Charles is saying the neighbors have needed for a long time.
I think a clear indication of how much empathy the governor had for the African-American community, and especially this situation, is his appointment of Tina Duskovich to the Florida Ethics Commission. I mean, that is tone deaf to what just happened here in Jacksonville.
Let's dive into that, because that's one of the points on this conversation. So DeSantis appointed Tina Duskovich to the Florida Ethics Commission. She's a former school board member in Brevard County and a co-founder of Moms for Liberty. So please, Charles, now that I've set the table, please explain your issue with it.
I mean, she and her organization are responsible for leading the charge on many of the oppressive policies in education that we're seeing today. And that is not an answer. That is not a representative answer for people in the black community, period. And I think that he knows that. So
we're going to go to the phones. We've got Jerry in the Beaches. Jerry, how are you this morning?
Excellent. How about yourself?
Good.
Thanks for the great conversation. Just a quick perspective. Don't we, in fact, have a three-party system already de facto with Democrats, MAGA, and Republicans? It seems like it's already segmented that way.
How would you call the difference between MAGA and Republicans? Because it seems like I'm just curious, like how you see the difference.
Well, it seems to me that the Republican Party is in the process of splitting. And in so doing, the MAGA voice is confusing the other potential candidates from differentiating in the race. And I think that's an interesting dynamic that seems to be unfolding right now.
I think he's right.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
What I've seen, because I'm new to Jacksonville, so I've hopped around from Daytona and Central Florida, and I've seen a split across the GOP chairs and groups. There seem to be just this divide. There are people that are way, way pro-Trump, and then there are people that are a little bit more moderate, and ne'er the two shall meet.
Yeah, but I guess the question I have is the people who I hear a lot about the GOP and people who are anti-Trump. But then also I see, like, it seems like, you know, they back a whole lot of his policies, and they you know, when you're talking about the Republican Party in Florida, at least the legislature seems to be in lockstep with Ron DeSantis, which is, you know, on the, I would say on the MAGA scale. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I think these parties, we have to remember, they're not monolithic. Okay? And this is an equal opportunity issue, okay, whether it's Republican or Democrat. And both parties have extreme elements, whether it's far right, MAGA, you know, whatever you want to call it, on the right or on the left, you know, far left on that part of it. And this goes across the board. So I think each party has to deal with these types of issues. I mean, in the Democratic Party right now, and this goes back even under, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, the word liberal is considered too moderate to a lot of people, right? So, you know, this goes both ways, not just a Republican issue.
I think it gets back to what we were discussing earlier about the DeSantis strategy of not wanting to take on Trump, is that, let's face it, if Trump does not win the Republican nomination and runs as a third-party candidate, he's going to get a lot of votes. If DeSantis didn't win the nomination and runs as a third party, which he's not going to do, but if he did in this hypothetical, he would not get many votes. So there is a really strong segment in the Republican Party that it's not just the policies of Trump. They really identify with him. And that's what we have this split that I don't think is there in the Democratic Party with any particular figure in the Democratic Party. It's definitely there in the Republican Party.
I just say that's why they're, when you watch the first debate, that's why everyone was so loud.
Yep.
Because they were trying to pretend like they're Donald Trump. Right?
Yeah.
The party has seemed to take over this, you know, they've seemed to seeded the ground on anger, right? And they're mad about everything all the time. And if you're not an angry politician in the Republican Party, you're not going to get the votes of the base. So that's what it seems. That's what my observation is.
Well, you made the point before, Charles, about that. A lot of these Republicans are lying in wait. It's almost a rope-a-dope,
right,
to wait for the former president to not being able to run, so then they can kind of move into that spot and get his hardcore 40% of followers and anybody else on top of that.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. And I think many people believe that if he's not around, that a lot of these folks are going to stay home. So, you know, they may be done in either way.
Yeah. You know. So last month, the city council opted to postpone the vote for general counsel nominee Randy DeFore while they await an opinion from the Florida Ethics Commission. Though the formal opinion isn't expected until October 20th, the city council president, Ron Salem, decided to move forward with the vote on September 26th without guidance from the Ethics Commission. David, why do you think he went on ahead and just, after asking for it, just moved past it?
Well, his stated reason is that he thought that Mayor Deegan would appoint Randy DeFore as acting general counsel on October 1st. And so he said in that scenario, we should vote prior to that and make clear that she is not our choice to be general counsel. But, you know, there's also Randy DeFore right now does not have the votes to be general counsel. There's a handful of council members who already said they're opposed to it. She needs to get 13 of 19 votes, so it's a high bar anyway because of the way the city charter works. So there's a sentiment, too, I think, on council that she doesn't have the support. Let's just get it done sooner rather than later and bring this to an end.
Is there any chance that she will withdraw like Al Ferraro did?
It's possible. You know, it depends, I think, on whether you had a number of council members publicly state, I'm a no vote. In which case, then you're just going through the motions of having an actual vote. On the other hand, Al Ferraro decided to withdraw. That was not something that the Deegan administration was ready to go forward, I think, with that. And so if Randy DeFore wants to stay in it and make her case, then I suspect they would still go through it with the vote. And they may feel like doing it now rather than waiting for the ethics opinion strengthens her hand, because then they can argue this should just be as they are. This should just be about qualifications. She's qualified. She may not be your favorite person, but she deserves to, she's qualified to be the next general counsel of the city.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things happening here. Number one is that the city council led by Ron Salem are continuously moving the goalpost on this, right? So they wanted the ruling from the ethics. Now they don't want to worry about waiting for ethics, and now they want to just go ahead and do the vote, right? So, and under the guise of that, they're worried that that Mayor Donna Deegan's going to, you know, put in Randy DeFore when the administration said they won't do it. So clearly, Ron Salem believes that Donna Deegan's a liar, because if he believed her, then he wouldn't be saying this. But clearly, he thinks the administration is going to try to pull a fast one and put DeFore in there for 90 days. Okay, so that's number one. Number two is you have to look at what the Deegan administration has done to this point, okay? And first, the Al Ferraro thing, that was dead on arrival, okay? This was a big miscalculation by the Deegan administration. He never had a chance, okay? based on a long list of factors, and I don't think we have enough time here, Al, to go into it. But okay, Al Ferraro had no chance in hell of getting that job. Okay, it wasn't going to happen with those Republicans on city council. Now, Randy DeFore, better chance, but again, not the relationships with those other council members that would make this a possibility, probably. And you have to wonder, why didn't the Deegan administration, and I'm assuming they did it, but I don't know if they did. Did they do their due diligence to see if the votes would be there? Because I don't know why you'd put these people forward and put them in these positions when they may not be able to get it. You should be able to feel it out ahead of time and put candidates and people out there and know if they have a shot. And right now we know that neither one of these candidates really are going to have a shot.
And we're going to go to the phones. We've got Michael Hoffman. Michael, how are you doing this morning?
Good morning. I wanted to comment that it looks like at this point there are four no's already, or five no's, and four of those are at-large members of the council. And really, this goes back to the heart of the problem with consolidation. There's a built-in bias here with those at-large seats. They dilute the vote of African-American voters. They dilute the vote of people of modest means, such as myself. So if we don't somehow look at this situation a little more closely, then we're never going to get anywhere with consolidation. And we'll have the same problem with four people or five people who essentially represent the Republican Party are going to make the determining vote for everything. Thank you.
Thank you. Charles?
I'm just perplexed a little bit because you got three, possibly four people who've already determined that they're not going to support the mayor's pick for general counsel, no matter what happens. Right. So, you know, and I think they probably owe the public an explanation of why they feel like she's unqualified and at least that much. And also, why put us through this exercise? You know, if you're going to be lobbying against her anyway. So, you know, this is really perplexing because from where I come from, the mayor had the privilege of choosing who they wanted as long as they were qualified for the job. Not if you like them or not.
And what's fascinating, Charles, is that you have members of council that appear to be going in lockstep on Randy DeFore, but I thought there's a thing called sunshine laws.
Right.
So it's interesting how a certain number of people feel a certain way, but yet you're not allowed to talk to each other. So how is everyone arriving at this destination but not taking the same journey together?
So this story kind of brings back a lot of the elements that we were talking about earlier with Governor DeSantis. Voting rights advocates are celebrating this week after a judge ruled that a redistricting act backed by Governor DeSantis is unconstitutional, saying it illegally reduced black electoral power and black voters must be, and so therefore it must be redrawn. And I think, you know, this story like points to exactly why, you know, some of the reason why you saw the rage at the vigil, at the prayer vigil where Jacoby Pittman talked about bringing gifts and Governor DeSantis came there and said, like, Governor DeSantis is trying to strip the black community of power. And then he comes to that black community to offer sympathy. But the community feels like you're by trying to take away our power and our voice, you help make these things happen. Like it all comes circle.
Yeah, I think the governor's map did accomplish two things. One, it scored him brownie points, or at least he was hoping it would score him brownie points on the national level because he guaranteed another seat in Congress for the party. Two, it also silenced the African-American community because they had no representation from someone who they could elect. And that way, you know, he could largely ignore issues related to the black community. Again, one of those things, like you mentioned now, that people aren't lost on. They see these things happening, and then you come to my house to say, you know, I heard about what happened, but I don't have anything, I ain't have anything to do with it, right? So, and people aren't buying that. And that's just, this is one of those things that, I think when we were on this show earlier, when this was in the news and it was happening, this was another one of those things that the governor was throwing against the wall to see if it stick. You know, he knew it was going to get passed You know, he knew it was going to go through. The district was going to be drawn. We'll see him in court.
And, well, it's still going to stay in court because now the state's appealing it. So
right.
It's not over yet.
It's
this
not
is
over
going
yet.
To go to the Florida Supreme Court.
Right.
And do you think he wanted it to go to the Supreme Court?
I don't think he cared.
I don't think he, yeah.
I think he just wanted to put a stake in the ground and try to get it. And this isn't the only place, right? There's other states, Georgia, Louisiana. There's other states where you have these type of battles, Alabama, where this is happening right now. And this is becoming the new normal.
Yeah, it's got to go to the Supreme Court by a ruling by December 31st. It was going straight to the Supreme Court. And I think the expectation all along was it was going to end up before the Florida Supreme Court. And, you know, this is a different court than the one that put in place the map a few years ago that created that Jacksonville to Tallahassee district that elected Al Lawson and kept Jacksonville's as really the decisive vote in who filled that seat. So I think we'll know in 3 months whether the Florida Supreme Court agrees with DeSantis or not, and I don't know that it's a slam dunk either way.
You're not going to get a new map by the time the next by the time they qualify for 2024.
No, we're not.
Well, they'll have a legislative session in early 2024. They'll draw a map, and it'll be ready to go for the next time around.
And it's that time again. Oh, I love it when a plan comes together. A little late, but it was good. It came in. It's a thunderstorm in Florida. You can't predict it. It happens. So we will start off with my man, Ben Becker. What you got for the lightning round, sir?
All right. The Jags open the season against the Colts on Sunday. I say they're the Colts because I don't say the word of the city they play in because they left the great city of Baltimore on a cold March night in 1984 and made Mayor Schaefer cry on national television. I hope they beat the Colts 100-0.
Pretty much.
Ben, you are my dude. the passion you delivered that. I love you. All right. David Bauerlein, please, sir.
So, all right. There was a world premiere of a movie called Bloody Frickin' Mary Thursday here in Jacksonville. It was filmed in Jacksonville, and it's, as you might imagine, a horror slasher film.
I would hope so.
The idea is that if you say three times Bloody Mary, this curse will appear. So, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody...
But you have to
let's
do it.
Not chance.
No. You have to do it in a bathroom with the door closed.
I know, with a mirror and et cetera.
So you're not going to get us here, thank you.
Don't do it at home.
Charles.
I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge the homegoing services for former Councilwoman Denise Lee tomorrow.
Yes.
Denise was a friend. She was the very first elected official whose campaign I worked on back in the 80s. So she's going to be missed.
Yes, absolutely. And Kazmira, what you got?
Well, I found the first Wednesday art walk this week, and so I'm looking forward to the next one because I only got about 5 minutes at it before I had to go to another government meeting. So, next time.
All right, and that is our Friday Media Roundtable. Thank you to all my guests. You guys were amazing as always.
Thank you, big guy.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll be back.
My name's Scott Detrow, and I host All Things Considered on the weekends. I really enjoy the challenge of considering all things. You know, you can be on the line with a senator, then you're shifting gears and you're talking to a musician, you know. For the bulk of my career as a member station reporter, I was a state house reporter. So many things that affect people's lives are happening in those buildings. In just about every state, there's a public radio reporter there. It is a very challenging time to be a reporter. The business models that made journalism work for decades have gone up in smoke, and people increasingly just tune in to news sources that tell them what they want to hear. Public radio stations have really kind of stepped up in the middle of all of this to tell you the facts, to give you the information you need to make your own decisions. The whole NPR network is stronger with your support. Give to this station today, and thanks.
Please call 353-9528 or visit wjct.org/radio.
Listeners with blindness or low vision can open up the local paper Sunday through Friday mornings at 9 with WJCT's Radio Reading Service. That's where you can hear what's in the Florida Times Union. Radio Reading Service volunteers read an hour of news, op-eds, even comics. Listen on Amazon Echo, Google Home, or on your smartphone using the WJCT mobile app and get the whole day's listening schedule at wjct.org/radio reading.
Hi, it's Ari Shapiro. On All Things Considered, we bring you stories that are interesting but not predictable.
Scientists have recorded a song made by a volcano.
One man has found solace tending to his pigeons.
One of the things I love about ice cream is it's never a bad time for it.
Listen to All Things Considered from NPR every afternoon.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
At Vistar Credit Union, we believe in helping members reach their financial goals and building stronger communities. It's why we offer our members better rates and give back to the places we call home. Vistar Credit Union. Visit vistarcu.org/join.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
On the Friday News Roundup this week, another government shutdown looms. The deadline for a last-minute save this time is September 30th. The Texas Attorney General's impeachment trial gets underway, and Hurricane Lee gains strength in the Atlantic. We'll get to all of it next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
I am trying so hard not to laugh. I don't know why David picked this music, but it's my jam. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Actually, what's interesting about this music is that it takes me back to my high school years, and I am sitting next to somebody I went to high school with. So, but let me go ahead and like do the introductions and we get into all that. Welcome back. You are listening to First Coast Connect, not Al Letson's personal flashback machine where we talk about my high school years. Baptist Health has launched a new program designed to help expecting mothers during pregnancy and postpartum. Motherhood Space Day program supports moms experiencing maternal mental health challenges. Dr. Jill Garrett, founding psychologist of the Motherhood Space at Baptist Medical Center, is here with me now. Hello, Dr. Garrett.
Hi, thanks for having us.
And Dr. Terry Andrews, Vice President of Behavioral Health and Director of Clinical Training at Baptist, is also here. Hello, Dr. Terry Andrews.
Hello, Al.
And Dr. Terry Andrews and I went to middle school and high school together.
Yep.
And I did not know until you walked in. I was like, wait, what? Like, no, I mean, I knew her, but I didn't know that you were going to be, because your last name is different.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So if Dr. Andrews calls me Alfie, you know, it's because she has the permission to do so, because she's old school. We go way back. That's so right. Please, Dr. Andrews, tell me about why the need for this space.
Sure. So every few years, we survey our community and through a community health needs assessment. And at the top, I would say top two, are behavior health and child and maternal health. And what we see is that postpartum depression is underdiagnosed and not recognized in the community just because of awareness and how to identify the symptoms, which Dr. Garrett can talk about. And so that's what we wanted to be able to get upstream to provide the best possible support, not only for the mom, but also for the baby, so that the baby has a wonderful trajectory and outcome.
Dr. Garrett, talk to me a little bit about postpartum and how all that stuff plays out. I've actually, a very dear friend of mine had to deal with postpartum for probably about a good year after after her child was born. And it was tough watching her go through it.
Yeah. So I try to let people know that it's not just depression, and it is also any emotional challenge that occurs during the period of pregnancy or the year or so after having had a baby. So it might be anxiety, it might be depression, it might be trauma. And the statistics are pretty shocking. We know that as many as 1 in 5 moms, 1 in 10 dads, and 1 in 3 women of color will experience what are called perinatal, which is the period of pregnancy and the postpartum period, mood or anxiety disorders, PMADs. So, shocking when you hear those numbers.
Mm-hmm. I think that I know that when my friend went through it, and this was, probably like a decade ago, there was just kind of this vibe from the people around her of like, oh, suck it up. You're fine. We'll watch the baby for a night, give you a night out, and you'll be fine tomorrow. But it's much deeper than that, right?
Yeah, and part of the reason that we're excited about this day program is because of that mentality. A lot of times, some of the symptoms people experience are dismissed, and so this day program that we've created has a lot of different great pieces of programming that are not going to dismiss moms and families, but instead support them using wellness, using trauma-informed yoga with Yoga for Change, including scholarships through the Arthur Vining Davis Foundation for our Medicaid moms, having no stigma zones, so working outside of a hospital, and giving evidence-based, so that means, research-supported skills that work for moms to get them feeling better and getting them back to their families.
Yeah, and Terry, Dr. Terry.
You can call me Terry.
Can you tell me some specifics about the program?
Sure. So one of the things that I am most excited about is this, as Dr. Garrett said, it's out of the four walls of the hospital. It's actually located at the Healthy Living Center at the Winston YMCA in Riverside. And so the moms have access to childcare while they're in her program. They have access to all the gym amenities there. It's just amazing way to be able to tap into. And also, we're partnering with the JTA, the Jacksonville Transportation Authority, to be able to provide free transportation to moms that don't have access to transportation, because that's a huge barrier, especially if they have multiple kids.
And how do people enroll for this program?
Yeah, so you're welcome to check out our website. And also we have a YouTube channel where we have some short video vignettes that kind of talk through some healthy coping strategies for all things pregnancy and postpartum. So they're free, they're short. And then you can also check out our website and talk to your doctors about the program, and or call us at our Baptist Behavioral Health Department and follow the prompts for the maternal mental health program. And then people would get an opportunity to meet with somebody like me to do a kind of intake and kind of get a sense of what's going on and find out if they're a good candidate for the program.
Yeah, I believe we're going to have links to your website on our website. So if you want to go to wjct.org, you can find all of that information. And you said the Winston YMCA, which I'm a member of. So you're talking about, every time I go to the gym, I just kind of go to the back entrance and that leads you into the gym. But there's a front part there that I'm always like, I wonder what they do here. So this is where you're doing it at, right? In the front part of the building.
Correct. And that's a community-based partnership between the YMCA, Baptist Health, Brooks Rehab, and Florida Blue. And one of the things I want to highlight for Dr. Garrett and her team, they are one of the only nationally certified perinatal psychologists in our area. So, it just brings an amazing level of expertise in treating this population.
Yeah, and this is free to everybody who enrolls?
So it is covered by insurance, and then Medicaid folks, we have scholarships.
All right. Thank you so much for coming in, Dr. Jill Garrett and Dr. Terry Andrews, my friend from middle school, which is amazing to me. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that is our program. I'm Al Letson. You've been listening to First Coast Connect. Our executive producer is music maestro David Luckin. Our producer is Stacey the Brain Bennett. Our director, the Steven Spielberg of the operation, is Brady Corum. We'll be back Monday. And if you missed anything, you can listen to the rebroadcast at 8 p.m. or you can find today's show at WJCT.org on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, y'all, keep your heart open for Duval and each other. Have a great weekend, and I will see you bright and early Monday morning.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.